Chapter 21. Drugs. One night in 1797, a 17-year-old chemist named Humphrey Davy was heating a mixture of damp iron filings and nitric acid. Cautiously, he bent forward to sniff the retort. The gas smelt sweetish and seemed to have no ill effect, which surprised him, since he had been warned that it could kill. He sniffed more deeply, and was suddenly filled with a sensation of lightness. There was a buzzing noise in his ears, and objects in the room seemed to be getting bigger and falling towards him. Oddly enough, he wasn't alarmed. On the contrary, he felt a tremendous gaiety and burst out laughing. And then he passed out. When he woke up, he exclaimed, "What a wonderful discovery! Laughing gas!" When he published the discovery 4 years later, in a book called Medicinal Gases, it launched him on the road to fame. Laughing gas, or nitrous air, as its discoverer, Joseph Priestley, had called it, became a craze. The apparatus was cheap, the chemicals easily obtainable. Unfortunately, they were often impure. The nitrous oxide gas became contaminated with the deadly nitrogen peroxide. Many people were poisoned, some died, and the gas-sniffing craze ended as suddenly as it had begun. Humphrey Davy didn't know it, but he had inaugurated the age of drugs. It's true that the world had known about drugs for a long time, alcohol, opium, hashish, tobacco, but no one thought of them as particularly harmful. For example, a mixture of opium and alcohol could be bought in any apothecary's shop. It was called laudanum, and parents gave it to their children to make them sleep. A few years after the publication of Davy's book, a young writer suffering from toothache bought laudanum at a druggist's in London's Oxford Street. Its effect on him was a revelation. "What a resurrection! What an apocalypse! That my pains had vanished was now a trifle in my eyes. This negative effect was swallowed up by the immensity of those positive effects which had opened before me in the abyss of divine enjoyment thus suddenly revealed." His name was Thomas de Quincey, and he was to discover, to his cost, that these excursions into the abyss of divine enjoyment left behind a feeling of dullness and languor. Although he lived to be 74 and wrote the celebrated Murder Considered as One of the Fine Arts, most of his work was in short reviews and essays. Laudanum robbed the famous English opium eater of the stamina to write the great books he dreamed of. And despite his confessions of an English opium eater, no one considered opium as any more dangerous than alcohol. In 1803, at about the same time that De Quincey was taking his first dose of laudanum, a young German chemist's assistant named Friedrich Wilhelm Schürtener was experimenting with opium in an attempt to isolate its sleep-giving component. One day he poured ammonia over the opium and was startled to see white crystals forming in the liquid. He tried this white powder on his dog and it fell asleep. He then invited three friends to join him in an experiment. They sat around a table and each took half a grain of the powder. It produced a sense of warmth and delight. A second half a grain made them feel deliciously sleepy and happy. A third half a grain put them into a deep sleep from which they woke up vomiting. They had taken an overdose of morphine, for this was the name that Schürtener gave to his drug, from the Greek word morpheus, sleep. So, for the first time, men became aware of the deadly nature of the magical painkiller. Those who took repeated quantities built up a resistance to it and needed larger doses. If withdrawn from it, they went through agonies, and if they continued feeding themselves increasingly larger doses, they degenerated and died. In the 1850s, there were sudden hopes of a solution to the problem of morphine addiction. A German doctor called Scherzer came back from Peru with some leaves of a plant called coca. The Indians of Peru would chew this and could then endure the most severe fatigues. Dr. Albert Niemann isolated its basic constituent in the laboratory and gave it the name cocaine. American doctors tried using the drug on morphine addicts, and it seemed to free them from the craving for morphine, until they realised that it did this by setting up a new addiction to cocaine. In 1898, another German chemist finally isolated the most dangerous of the alkaloids derived from opium, heroin, which proved to be the greatest killer of all. By this time, everyone realised that the real problem was not the drug, but the people who trafficked in it. And the world's chief drug trafficker was, unfortunately, also its most powerful seagoing nation, Britain. The British discovered opium when they invaded India. Its use had been known since the days of Homer, who refers to it, but the Indians, with their misery and poverty, were the first to make large-scale use of it. By 1830, the East India Company had a monopoly on Indian opium. Having discovered that India was so profitable, the British wanted to trade with China. But the Chinese were traditionally isolationist, with their rigid hierarchies and ancient customs. They didn't want anything to do with the white man. So, with typical cunning, the natives of perfidious Albion used opium as a lever to open the door into China. Their ships sailed to Macau and traded their opium for tea. The opium went upriver to the sacred city of Canton, where no white man was allowed to set foot. Soon the Cantonese were so hooked on opium that the British had to supply it in bulk. A wealthy group of Cantonese called the Hong Merchants became the go-betweens. The British and American ships would anchor downriver at Macau. The Hong merchants would go on board and do their business, and then hordes of junks would take the chests of opium, weighing more than 100 weight each, back to Canton. They would bring tea in exchange. The ships would then set sail, duly chased by vessels of the Chinese Navy, which fired salvos after them. This was strictly a game. In fact, the British ships lagged to give the Chinese a chance to send their shots whistling near their bows. The Hong merchants then reported to the Emperor that once again the wicked foreigners had been repelled by the Imperial Navy. All would be peaceful until the next year, when the British returned with another £4 or 5 million worth of opium. For years this comedy was played out to the mutual satisfaction of both sides. But then in 1838 the Emperor appointed a rigidly honest official called Lin Jiazhu to stop the traffic. This was a major mistake. Lin seized more than 1,000 tons of opium and dumped it into the river. The enraged British government sent in the Royal Navy. It went up and down the coast, bombarding Chinese towns and captured the island of Shusan. The Chinese troops, with their bows and arrows, were mown down. The humiliated emperor had to backpedal. He paid the British $6 million in compensation for the destroyed opium and gave them the port of Hong Kong. When the First Opium War ended in 1842, the Chinese also had to pay another $21 million in compensation. They now had opium on their doorstep, flooding in through Hong Kong. At first, the Chinese mixed their opium with tobacco. Later, they invented the opium pipe. Like the Indians, they proved to be highly susceptible to this new drug. The reason, quite simply, was poverty. When any nation has widespread poverty and some cheap drug that's easy to obtain, the result is bound to be widespread addiction. The same thing happened in London in the 1690s with the introduction of gin. By 1914, about half the population of China used opium. The new opium derivative, heroin, was also entering in vast quantities. One Dutch firm alone was shipping in £4,600 a year, at present-day prices worth $500 million. No wonder, therefore, the Chinese felt that the foreign devils were sapping their lifeblood, and periodically rebelled and slaughtered every white man they could lay their hands on. It's a typical irony of history that the heroin which is now proving such a menace to the civilizations of Europe and America should be flooding in from the East, through the Asiatic connection. In 1853, Dr. Alexander Wood invented one more aid to the decline of the West, a hypodermic syringe for the injection of morphine. By the 1880s, the most famous fictional detective of all time, Sherlock Holmes, was injecting himself with doses of morphine and cocaine and explaining to the horrified Dr. Watson that it saved him from boredom. Even at that late date, the average European and American failed to recognise the gravity of the drug menace. It took America until 1914 to pass legislation, the Harrison Act, against the illegal flow of narcotics into the country. By that time, addiction was already widespread. One American in every 400 was an addict. The Act had the effect of lowering this to one in every 4,000. Harry J. Anslinger, then head of the Bureau of Narcotics, described how, as a child, in around 1904, he was sent to urgently buy morphine at the local druggist's. A female addict was screaming with agony in the upstairs room of a farmhouse. The druggist handed the morphine to the 12-year-old boy without question. In 1930, when Anslinger became a commissioner of narcotics in the newly formed Federal Bureau of Narcotics, the Chinese were still the chief opium traders in the United States, and there were opium dens in just about every large city. In those days, in spite of the example of Al Capone, the average American still thought of the typical underworld gangster as a sinister Chinaman with a dragon tattooed on his arm. It was the world of Fu Manchu. The Tongs had started in the goldfields in the 1850s and spread to New York, San Francisco, and every other city with a Chinese quarter. The word made people shudder. The hatchet men of the Tongs had a reputation for sadistic brutality. A man who offended them or refused to pay protection money might be found staked out in his own sitting room, bleeding from a thousand cuts. Anslinger started by raiding the 30 or so opium dens in Washington, D.C. The Chinese found it unbelievable. They had been operating for so long they couldn't imagine being closed down. Even though the word got around that the police were acting, the dens stayed open and were in full operation when the detectives marched in. One of the chief spurs to Anslinger's assault on the opium dens was sexual scandal involving white girls, many of them teenagers of good families. The Roaring Twenties, with their speakeasies and bootleg gin, had liberated them. They found visits to Chinatown thrilling, and their first experiences of opium smoking delightful. As soon as they were hooked, they were persuaded to take part in sexual orgies. The Chinese, according to Anslinger, put a high premium on pretty, cultured white girls, the kind who would normally get engaged to a husky college boy from an upper-class family. Many of the girls were unconscious when they lost their virginity. If their new way of life worried them, they were soothed and relaxed by special capsules handed out by Joe Singh, the Chinaman in whose apartment the Washington orgies took place. The capsules contained heroin. As soon as the victims became dependent, they were sent to parties with other girls, at which their clients were Chinese. It was not too difficult to put the clamps on the Chinese opium dens, but the effects were not wholly desirable. The bootleg era was coming to an end, and the Irish and Italian mobsters were growing unpopular with the American public. Events like the St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago had made them too notorious. When Capone was arrested for carrying a gun in 1929, the gang saw that the bad old days were over. The original mafia, or Black Hand, was controlled by Italian gangsters who believed in looking out for themselves. Moustache Pete's, the new generation called them. One of the up-and-coming young men was a Sicilian named Salvatore Luciano, later better known as Lucky Luciano. He believed that it was a mistake to be a loner. His boss, Joe Masseria, the man who had given him his underworld training, took the opposite view. One night, after a large meal with Luciano, Masseria was riddled with bullets. Luciano was out washing his hands at the time. And Lucky's views found many converts at that dinner on September the 11th, 1931. Between 30 and 40 Moustache Petes were murdered across America in a kind of anticipation of Hitler's Night of the Long Knives. The old mafia vanished. A new organisation, sometimes known as the Syndicate, sometimes as Murder Incorporated, sometimes as the Unione Siciliano, spread up across the United States. Gangsterism ceased to be a matter of public scandal. It became quietly legal, and mobs throughout the country cooperated. Many of the old Moustache Petes had refused to touch drugs. Luciano, however, had always trafficked in drugs, although his main interest was prostitution, using the drugs to hook recruits. But now the Volstead Act was repealed, and prohibition was no longer in force. The mobsters had to find another way of making money. There were various forms of protection, in the docks, in the garment industry. There was gambling, and there was heroin. Luciano, in partnership with Louis Buchalter, known as Lepke, operated in all these lucrative fields. The drugs operation became big business in 1935 when three racketeers living in the Bronx grew tired of the drudgery involved in processing their own heroin with homemade equipment and asked Lepke to join them in smuggling heroin from China. Lepke knew how to go about it. He bribed two customs officials to supply him with stamps used to indicate that a piece of luggage had been inspected. A trunk packed with heroin would then be unloaded at the dock. Its owner would casually sit down on it for a moment, and when he moved away, the appropriate customs stamp would be in place, and a porter would then take the trunk to a waiting vehicle. A resentful ex-lady friend squealed on Lepke. Anslinger's men moved in and made arrests. Lepke himself disappeared and then proceeded to cover his tracks with a campaign of mass murder. He had the money to pay Murder Incorporated assassins to kill potential witnesses against him. An equally effective method, with family men, was to kill one of their children, with the threat that the same would happen to the others. As the narcotics operatives felt Lepke slipping through their fingers, they turned the full heat on the underworld, a campaign of non-stop raids and harassments. It worked. The gang bosses, tired of all this activity, sent messages to Lepke that if he didn't give himself up, they would see to it that his corpse was delivered to Anslinger. Accordingly, he surrendered. It took Anslinger until 1944 to see justice done, but he finally had the satisfaction of seeing Lepke go to the electric chair. Luciano was also removed from the mob scene in 1936, charged with organising prostitution on a grand scale. He went to jail for a 50-year term, but was released in 1945 on payment of a large donation to the Republican Party funds and deported to Sicily. He had also organised an effective anti-sabotage campaign from inside prison, which had substantially aided the American war effort. But the removal of Luciano and Lepke made no difference to the drugs racket, for even in those early days it brought in larger sums of money than gambling or protection. A consignment of heroin that cost $100,000 could be resold in 1936 for $5 million. Nowadays, with the price at $100,000 a kilo, it could fetch $500 million. The China connection was by no means the most important. In the 1920s, before the authorities were fully aware of the dangers of heroin, an international businessman named Elias Eliopoulos had large quantities of opium shipped from China to France, where it was processed quite legally in French drug factories. When the government finally decided to make this illegal, Eliopoulos persuaded the factories to move to Istanbul in Turkey, where the trade flourished. The new ruler of Turkey, Kemal Atatürk, closed these factories at Christmas 1931. But Turkey was a poor country. Opium was big business. The factories moved to the remoter parts of the country, where they were no longer under the eye of Kemal, and the fields of Turkey began to produce vast quantities of poppies. In the late 1960s, the Turkish government finally began to respond to US pressure to clamp down on opium. But by then it was too late. Far too late. World production of opium was up to 1,200 tons a year, and in the United States, drug addiction was back to its old 1914 level, one addict in every 400 people. But the population had more than doubled since 1914. Nearly 60% of the world's opium production came from the drugs triangle in the highlands of Burma, Thailand and Laos. In fact, during the Vietnam War, the American forces actively encouraged the production of opium in these remote areas because it brought prosperity and kept the peasants anti-communist. Ironically, there's very little heroin addiction in Turkey or in Southeast Asia, possibly because the pressures of modern life have not yet sent the demand soaring. In 1943, a new chapter in the history of drugs opened at the Sandoz Chemical Works at Basel in Switzerland. A chemist named Albert Hofmann had synthesised a substance called lysergic acid diethylamide, LSD for short. On April the 16th, he began to feel dizzy and went home. Like Humphrey Davy and Friedrich Zerturner before him, he experienced strange and marvellous sensations, dazzling images and colours, a kind of delirium. He had breathed in only 100 micrograms of LSD, enough to induce visions. After World War II, American psychologists began to experiment with the new hallucinogens, including a closely related drug, mescaline. It seemed harmless and non-addictive, and the writer Aldous Huxley, who tried it in 1953, recommended that it should become as freely available as tobacco or alcohol, since it was less harmful than either. When the young generation of hippies discovered how easy it was to manufacture, LSD became almost as freely available as alcohol. Only then was it realised that even if LSD is not addictive, it is liable to create psychosis and lead to violence. In just over a decade, LSD became as popular among the younger generation in the United States as opium was in China 150 years ago. Under the Nixon administration, the budget of the Narcotics Bureau was increased from $78 million to over $500 million, and new drug laws made it possible for a pusher to go to jail for life. The immediate effects, however, were counterproductive. They clogged the courts with a backlog of cases and pushed up the price of heroin. The world was as far away as ever from the solution of its drugs problem.